Hello everybody, welcome back to the podcast. My name is Raphael, I'm your host here. We do a lot of talk and meditation and exercises here, contemplations also. And today I would like to share, to continue what we did in the previous episodes where we had a rather large introduction, I'm going to share with you some lectures that I did for my online course on self-transcendence and meditation. And I'm going to put part one and two of our consciousness module, so I hope that you enjoy. If you have any questions, if you have any feedback, don't hesitate to send it to me. You can find the link in the show notes for the course and for all of our useful links. Hope you enjoy these lectures. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. As I said before, we can talk, we can theorize, study, interpret, and have a few fun ideas on the source of thought and on the meaning of consciousness. I have my own theories that come from different theories, from people that I admire, from people that I respect, and I feel very strongly about them. Or rather, let's put it this way, I'm very enthusiastic about certain theories of thought and consciousness because they correlate to my non-intellectualized understanding of these ideas. Through practice of meditation, meditative techniques, contemplation of nature, and so on. The truth is that we're unsure. We don't know what consciousness is and where it emerges from. And I've done a lot of research on studies that aim to prove the existence of such thing as cosmic consciousness, universal consciousness, the unified field of consciousness. And that's all very fascinating and interesting, but truth be told, most of these studies have either been flawed by the people doing them, or they're inconclusive. Certain of these studies are inconclusive yet, because we don't have the technology as of today to go further. And so you'll have two categories of scientists, you know. You have scientists that have integrity that will say, well, actually, we don't really know. We're onto something. We're led to believe that, you know, this and that, everything is made of the same energy substance, but we're unable to define it. And then you have the other people, scientists, and I'm doing air quotes in front of my microphone that I don't think that you can see or hear or feel, but I'm doing air quotes, scientists or pseudo-scientists that will tell you that for certain this and that, but they're usually funded by groups, cults, organizations that I will not mention here, that have an agenda behind the certainty of these theories. And usually these agendas are economical and trying to convert you into something or bring you into something. Perceptual awareness is how Aristotle would describe consciousness. I like this. Perceptual awareness. And so, without getting in your way, I'm asking you, how do you perceive consciousness? How do you perceive consciousness? Answer this question. Take your journal out, write about it, contemplate on it, meditate on it. And in the meantime, here's some ideas that I think might be interesting. One of the states of consciousness that we know and experience every day is simply being awake. We're awake and we perceive information through our senses, filtered by our mind, by our ego, thoughts, and we make decisions based on the opinion that we have toward multiple pieces of data. In that sense, we are awake, but we're heavily sedated because we're not really awake or aware enough to step in the boundaries that lay between our thoughts, between our reactions and our decisions. And so we're lost in our thoughts that we confuse with reality because they can indeed be very convincing. And we like to think of ourselves as quite clever and understanding of ourselves and of our surroundings. If I see that this hat is blue, I think it's blue, and so I'm convinced it's blue, it's not red. And for the rest of my life, no matter what happens, even if I make a picture and put it on Photoshop and decrease the saturation to make it black and white, or if I do some more fancy Photoshop tricks and change the hue to make the hat, that blue hat yellow, it's still a blue hat. And in my mind, it's still a blue hat. And for a very long time, it might still always be a blue hat. There's an analogy that I love to recount, which is the story of a person that is introduced to a fig tree. I miss my little Croatian island. So we're going to give the example of a fig tree. I was there, you know, I go there in the vacations, and they have the most beautiful fig trees with the most delicious figs that you've ever tasted in your life. It tastes like honey, basically. But anyway, think of a guy that has never seen a fig tree in his life. He doesn't know what a fig tree is. He's never seen one, never tasted a fig, nothing. Okay? But the first time that he sees a fig tree, you say, hey, this is a fig tree. It's in December. So his very enthusiastic friend tells him, let's say that it's me, right? Hello, my friend. This is a fig tree. It gives us fruit called figs. They're the sweetest and most delicious fruits that you could ever imagine. Well, the guy said, that's not what I see, and therefore it is not what I believe. This tree has nothing else on its dead branches than a bit of snow and maybe a little bit of frosting, but that's it. And he would be right, wouldn't he? Because that is what he perceived, and this is what he thought, and so it's true for him. A fig tree is simply a few branches with snow and ice on it. His friend tells him, but wait, it's because it's winter, but you'll see in a few months, you will taste the most delicious fruits in your entire life. Well, the guy doesn't believe a word of it, but still it's a good friend, so he says, okay. Comes back a few months later. Oh, the tree is nice and green, and there are even a flower or two here and there, but no fruit. I knew I should have not come back, he thinks to himself. This tree has no fruit. He tells his friend, look, these are leaves and a few flowers, but I'm not a goat, so I'll probably not digest them. His friend tells him, oh no, you came back too soon. You see, after winter comes spring, and in spring we get the leaves. They're not edible, but come back in a few months. So he does. He comes back in a few months, still no fruits. The leaves are big, beautiful, you know, those shapes of the fig trees, beautiful. The flowers look nice, and it's a beautiful tree. It is really a beautiful tree. And he tells his friend, okay, I give up. This is a really nice tree, but the fruits you promised are not there. His friend tells him, but it's still summertime. Figs only come in the early autumn. Come back, not in a few months, but just in a few weeks. Well, the guy doesn't go back because, like any of us, he lost patience. And it's understandable. Here's this tree that he had never seen before. He visited it 3 times with months in between each visit. So he doesn't believe that these have really nice fruits. He's never seen them. He's never tasted them. From there on until the day he visits around September-ish, maybe somewhere in his life, he will never see nor believe that this beautiful tree can make delicious fruits. You see what I mean? Where I'm trying to get at here? I remember when I was a kid, I heard the story of a little girl. And maybe that story was true, maybe it's a legend, who cares? It's a tale told for fruit prevention, maybe. But this little girl was asked to draw a fish. And, you know, in his school, you have to draw a fish. So she drew what she knew to be a fish, a yellow rectangle. The teacher then asked, are you sure that this is the only fish you can think of? And so the courageously creative little girl went on and thought about it, put all her power, all her focus, her creative spirit at play, and went on to draw another fish. This time, it was a yellow square, a yellow rectangle, but it was in the burger bun with sauce and salad. And we can laugh, we can cry, we can judge. Poor little girl, she never saw a real fish. Or poor girl, she's only fed with processed food. That's not the point. The point is that this little girl was very content. She was asked to draw a fish. And as a good little student, she drew what she knew to be a fish. Would you tell her, well, it's not a real fish, or that is a fish with a mix, you know, mixed with thousands of other fishes in the food processor? Probably not. I love these little stories as they really illustrate the concepts of perception and, of course, of what we're talking here, which is consciousness. The thing that we're conscious of a lot of the time is actually either an illusion or a highly distorted interpretation of reality. We are not our thoughts. That is an illusion. You can think of yourself as such and such, but that is just the sum of your descriptive thoughts or the descriptive thoughts of someone else. Let's say you are a generous person. That's great. You're a nice lady or a kind man. Well, how do you know that you're generous? How is this your personality? Well, because people told me I was a generous person. Well, yeah, but is that really true? Well, yes, it is true because I act with Generosity, I give, I'm not selfish. But why are you not selfish? Well, I'm not selfish because actually I am quite selfish, but I like myself and I'm less selfish, and so I act unselfishly because I'm a selfish person. Therefore, I'm a generous man. And again, the infinite loop. We've seen this infinite loop many, many times, so maybe this gives us a clue. Now, this is a fun example to play with, but it's true, isn't it? The way we are perceived by other people in the positive or negative light doesn't matter. Though through time and repetition, that becomes who you are. And then you are so convinced about that, that taking it, you know, black and white as a fact, you start acting that way because you know that this is who you are. Now, it can be great when people tell you you're nice and you're generous and talented, but sometimes people can tell really not nice things. People can lose track of who they are. When people constantly and for years tell someone that, you know, they're weird or crazy, that person starts to believe it. And so then what? Will he or she act like a crazy, weird person? Well, you better believe it, because other people's opinions of who he is has merged to the thought that he has towards himself, and so that is who he is, that is his personality, and he will act on that. That is why social media creates so much suffering in people. And again, I don't want to digress too much on social media. I think we've talked about it sufficiently in this course, which is completely out of topic. But especially for young people, if they don't have followers and likes, that means that they're inadequate. That's what they feel. They're not loved because they're no good. They're not rich enough. They're not good looking enough. They're not thin enough. They don't have enough material things. And I'm taking a shortcut here. I apologize for being oversimplifying things. But again, I don't want to digress too much here. But this, you know, this causes serious mental disorders. It creates these feelings of not belonging, of inadequacy. There's a story that I like about the frog and the scorpion. Maybe you've heard about that story before. If you have, you've probably not heard me saying it before, so that would be something new for you. So, a frog is swimming around with her nice little French swimsuit. That's why I'm imagining a frog right now in my mind. You see how consciousness is that? She's in the middle of the pond and she sees a scorpion that is having huge difficulties. Scorpion can't swim. The scorpion sees the frog and starts yelling for help. Help me, dear frog, please help me. I'm begging you. I do not know how to swim. And so the frog goes there to see him and she says, well, what do you want me to do? To which the scorpion replies, let me hop on your back and swim me to the other side of the pond. The frog replies, well, no, absolutely not. If you get on my back, you will sting me and I'll die. The scorpion, really struggling to speak as he can't float at all, says, I promise I won't. Look, if I sting you whilst I'm on your back, we'll both die, because you'll die from the poison and I'll drown. And I really don't want to die. So the frog thinks to herself that, yeah, indeed, that makes total sense. He won't sting her because, as he said, if he does, then there in the middle of the pond, she'll die, but he will too. So the conclusion is for sure he's not going to sting her. Okay, the frog says, hop on. Here we go. They start to swim, and sure enough, a few seconds later, when they're really far from the shore still, the frog feels the biggest pain she's ever felt before. Ah, she looks back and she sees the venomous scorpion's tail stabbed in the middle of her back. She starts yelling in pain, in agony. And with her last word, she asks, but why did you do that? Now we'll both die. And the scorpion, also about to die, drowning, replies, because it's in my nature. And they both die. This is a story, but it's more of a fable. And like all fables, they come with a lesson. I would like you to take your journals out, unless you're driving. If so, do it later. And let me know, tell me, what's the lesson here? I'll see you in the next lecture to continue to talk about consciousness. As I said before, we can talk, we can theorize, study, interpret, and have a few fun ideas on the source of thought and on the meaning of consciousness. I have my own theories that come from different theories, from people that I admire, from people that I respect, and I feel very strongly about them. Or rather, let's put it this way, I'm very enthusiastic about certain theories of thought and consciousness because they correlate to my non-intellectualized understanding of these ideas. Through practice of meditation, meditative techniques, contemplation of nature, and so on. The truth is that we're unsure. We don't know what consciousness is and where it emerges from. And I've done a lot of research on studies that aim to prove the existence of such thing as cosmic consciousness, universal consciousness, the unified field of consciousness. And that's all very fascinating and interesting. But truth be told, most of these studies have either been flawed by the people doing them or they're inconclusive. Certain of these studies are inconclusive yet because we don't have the technology as of today to go further. And so you'll have two categories of scientists. You know, you have scientists that have integrity that will say, well, actually, we don't really know. We're on to something. We're led to believe that, you know, this and that, everything is made of the same energy substance, but we're unable to define it. And then you have the other people, scientists, and I'm doing air quotes in front of my microphone that I don't think that you can see or hear or feel, but I'm doing air quotes, scientists or pseudo-scientists that will tell you that for certain this and that, but they're usually funded by groups, cults, organizations that I will not mention here that have an agenda behind the certainty of these theories. And usually these agendas are economical and trying to convert you into something or bring you into something. Perceptual awareness is how Aristotle would describe consciousness. I like this. Perceptual awareness. And so, without getting in your way, I'm asking you, how do you perceive consciousness? How do you perceive consciousness? Answer this question. Take your journal out, write about it, contemplate on it, meditate on it. And in the meantime, here's some ideas that I think might be interesting. And one of the states of consciousness that we know and experience every day is simply being awake. We're awake and we perceive information through our senses, filtered by our mind, by our ego, thoughts, and we make decisions based on the opinion that we have toward multiple pieces of data. In that sense, we are awake, but we're heavily sedated because we're not really awake or aware enough to step in the boundaries that lay between our thoughts, between our reactions and our decisions. And so we're lost in our thoughts that we confuse with reality because they can indeed be very convincing. And we like to think of ourselves as quite clever and understanding of ourselves and of our surroundings. If I see that this hat is blue, I think it's blue, and someone convinces it's blue, it's not red. And for the rest of my life, no matter what happens, even if I make a picture and put it on Photoshop and decrease the saturation to make it black and white, or if I do some more fancy Photoshop tricks and change the hue to make the hat, that blue hat yellow, it's still a blue hat. And in my mind, it's still a blue hat. And for a very long time, it might still always be a blue hat. There's an analogy that I love to recount, which is the story of a person that is introduced to a fig tree. I miss my little Croatian island. So we're going to give the example of a fig tree. I was there, you know, I go there in the vacations, and they have the most beautiful fig trees with the most delicious figs that you've ever tasted in your life. It tastes like honey, basically. But anyway, think of a guy that has never seen a fig tree in his life. He doesn't know what a fig tree is. He's never seen one, never tasted a fig, nothing, okay? But the first time that he sees a fig tree, you say, hey, this is a fig tree. It's in December. So his very enthusiastic friend tells him, let's say that it's me, right? Hello, my friend. This is a fig tree. It gives us fruit called figs. They're the sweetest and most delicious fruits that you could ever imagine. Well, the guy said, that's not what I see, and therefore it is not what I believe. This tree has nothing else on its dead branches than a bit of snow and maybe a little bit of frosting, but that's it. And he would be right, wouldn't he? Because that is what he perceived and this is what he thought. And so it's true for him. A fig tree is simply a few branches with snow and ice on it. His friend tells him, but wait, it's because it's winter, but you'll see in a few months, you'll taste the most delicious fruits in your entire life. Well, the guy doesn't believe a word of it, but still it's a good friend, so he says, okay. comes back a few months later. Oh, the tree is nice and green, and there are even a flower or two here and there, but no fruit. I knew I should have not come back, he thinks to himself. This tree has no fruit. He tells his friend, look, these are leaves and a few flowers, but I'm not a goat, so I'll probably not digest them. His friend tells him, oh no, you came back too soon. You see, after winter comes spring, and in spring we get the leaves. They're not edible, but come back in a few months. So he does. He comes back in a few months, still no fruits. The leaves are big, beautiful, you know, those shapes of the fig trees, beautiful. The flowers look nice, and it's a beautiful tree. It is really a beautiful tree. And he tells his friend, okay, I give up. This is a really nice tree, but the fruits you promised are not there. His friend tells him, but it's still summertime. Figs only come in the early autumn. Come back, not in a few months, but just in a few weeks. Well, the guy doesn't go back because, like any of us, he lost patience. And it's understandable. Here's this tree that he had never seen before. He visited it 3 times with months in between each visit. So he doesn't believe that these have really nice fruits. He's never seen them, he's never tasted them. From there on, until the day he visits around September-ish, maybe somewhere in his life, he will never see nor believe that this beautiful tree can make delicious fruits. You see what I mean? Where I'm trying to get at here? I remember when I was a kid, I heard the story of a little girl. And maybe that story was true, maybe it's a legend, who cares? It's a tale told for fruit prevention, maybe. But this little girl was asked to draw a fish. And, you know, in his school, you have to draw a fish. So she drew what she knew to be a fish, a yellow rectangle. The teacher then asked, are you sure that this is the only fish you can think of? And so the courageously creative little girl went on and thought about it, put all her power, all her focus, her creative spirit at play, and went on to draw another fish. This time, it was a yellow square, a yellow rectangle, but it was in the burger bun with sauce and salad. And we can laugh, we can cry, we can judge. Poor little girl, she never saw a real fish. Or poor girl, she's only fed with processed food. That's not the point. The point is that this little girl was very content. She was asked to draw a fish. And as a good little student, she drew what she knew to be a fish. Would you tell her, well, it's not a real fish, or that is a fish with a mix, you know, mixed with thousands of other fishes in the food processor? Probably not. I love these little stories as they really illustrate the concepts of perception and, of course, of what we're talking here, which is consciousness. The thing that we're conscious of a lot of the time is actually either an illusion or a highly distorted interpretation of reality. We are not our thoughts. That is an illusion. You can think of yourself as such and such, but that is just the sum of your descriptive thoughts or the descriptive thoughts of someone else. Let's say you are a generous person. That's great. You're a nice lady or a kind man. Well, how do you know that you're generous? How is this your personality? Well, because people told me I was a generous person. Well, yeah, but is that really true? Well, yes, it is true because I act with generosity, I give, I'm not selfish. But why are you not selfish? Well, I'm not selfish because actually I am quite selfish, but I like myself and I'm less selfish, and so I act unselfishly because I'm a selfish person. Therefore, I'm a generous man. And again, the infinite loop. We've seen this infinite loop many, many times, so maybe this gives us a clue. Now, this is a fun example to play with, but it's true, isn't it? The way we are perceived by other people in a positive or negative light doesn't matter. Though through time and repetition, that becomes who you are. And then you are so convinced about that, that taking it, you know, black and white as a fact, you start acting that way because you know that this is who you are. Now it can be great when people tell you you're nice and you're generous and talented, but sometimes people can tell really not nice things. People can lose track of who they are. When people constantly and for years tell someone that, you know, they're weird or crazy, that person starts to believe it. And so then what? Will he or she act like a crazy, weird person? Well, you better believe it, because other people's opinions of who he is has merged to the thought that he has towards himself, and so that is who he is, that is his personality, and he will act on that. That is why social media creates so much suffering in people. And again, I don't want to digress too much on social media. I think we've talked about it sufficiently in this course, which is completely out of topic. But especially for young people, if they don't have followers and likes, that means that they're inadequate. That's what they feel. They're not loved because they're no good. They're not rich enough. They're not good looking enough. They're not thin enough. They don't have enough material things. And I'm taking a shortcut here. I apologize for being oversimplifying things. But again, I don't want to digress too much here. But this, you know, this causes serious mental disorders. It creates these feelings of not belonging, of inadequacy. There's a story that I like about the frog and the scorpion. Maybe you've heard about that story before. If you have, you've probably not heard me saying it before, so that'll be something new for you. So, a frog is swimming around with her nice little French swimsuit. That's why I'm imagining a frog right now in my mind. You see how consciousness is that? She's in the middle of the pond and she sees a scorpion that is having huge difficulties. Scorpion can't swim. The scorpion sees the frog and starts yelling for help. Help me, dear frog, please help me. I'm begging you. I do not know how to swim. And so the frog goes there to see him. And she says, well, what do you want me to do? To which the scorpion replies, let me hop on your back and swim me to the other side of the pond. The frog replies, well, no, absolutely not. If you get on my back, you will sting me and I'll die. The scorpion, really struggling to speak, as he can't float at all, says, I promise I won't. Look, if I sting you whilst I'm on your back, we'll both die, because you'll die from the poison and I'll drown, and I really don't want to die. So the frog thinks to herself that, yeah, indeed, that makes total sense. He won't sting her because, as he said, if he does, then they're in the middle of the pond, she'll die, but he will too. So the conclusion is for sure he's not going to sting her. Okay, the frog says, hop on. Here we go. They start to swim, and sure enough, a few seconds later, when they're really far from the shore still, the frog feels the biggest pain she's ever felt before. Ah, she looks back and she sees the venomous scorpion's tail stabbed in the middle of her back. She starts yelling in pain, in agony. And with her last word, she asks, but why did you do that? Now we'll both die. And the scorpion, also about to die, drowning, replies, because it's in my nature. And they both die. This is a story, but it's more of a fable. And like all fables, they come with a lesson. I would like you to take your journals out, unless you're driving. If so, do it later. And let me know. Tell me, what's the lesson here? I'll see you in the next lecture to continue to talk about consciousness. Okay, friends, so where were we? Consciousness, being awake, nature, woof woof. The next two states of consciousness that we live in with every day, or most days, are the states, I hope every day, are the state of being fast asleep and deep sleep, and therefore we have no noticeable thoughts. And the third state of consciousness is a dreaming state. Now, funny enough, this can be when you're asleep as well as when you're daydreaming, but let's not get into details here. You can read a lot of really good books and material on sleep and on what happens in your brain while you sleep. One good book that I recommend, that I really highly recommend that you read, is Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. Really interesting book about sleep, but also about why sleep is so important. In fact, if one day we talk about self-care habits, sleep is the most important one for me. Yes, even more than meditation. Sleep is the number one self-care habit. It's the most important thing for me to feel good and to have a good day, to be creative, to do my best work. But let's not digress. Let's go to the subject of transcendence. What is this state, this fourth state of consciousness, transcendence? What is it? What does it do? How does it feel like? How do we know we're there? How do we get there? And so on. This is by far the question that I'm asked the most. Practically, I think it's up there anyway, since I started my YouTube channel. And my first answer is usually, well, it's difficult to answer. Describing the feeling of transcendence, like describing the feeling of love, for example, it's very hard, especially to someone that has never felt it. Of course, you can be poetic and describe a few sensations, like what we might have physically, the way we react, but as you know, if you've ever fell in love, there is more, much more deeper aspect to love than just the butterflies in your tummy and forgetfulness. Otherwise, love would be explained by too much hummus that passed expiration date. There's more than those butterflies to love. And it's the same thing with transcendence. It's a highly complex state. It's like, describe the taste of water to someone that has never tasted water. Now, describe it in a way that doesn't make any comparisons to anything else, such as not quite this, not quite that, but nearly. Like, let's say a kiwi. If you've never tasted a kiwi, how would you describe a kiwi without any comparisons, right? Because you would normally say, well, it's not quite a peach, it's not quite an apple, it's more acid and it's green, not orange, and the skin is also soft, but a different kind of soft, and it doesn't have a stone, but the middle isn't as tender as the sides. It's not lemony acid, but it is quite acid, maybe orange, maybe an orange that's not ripe yet, and so on. You know, this is how you would describe something that you don't know. But I'm not sure that this is the right way to describe. And again, you go into the infinite loop of words not being sufficient to describe all these incredible phenomena. Okay, so if you're a little bit more creative and imaginative than me, I'm sure you can kind of get it done for a kiwi, for a kiwi, kind of, but not really. And I know that you're looking for really as opposed to kind of, right? But what did we say when we talked about expressing ideas and words in reality? How compatible are they really? Okay, I'll try, but I guarantee you I will not be successful in that endeavor. If you want to find out what it is, what it means, what it does, what it represents, and what it feels like, you're going to have to experience it yourself. How? Well, I'm glad you asked. Meditation is a very practical way of experiencing glimpses of transcendence. It is not the only way, but this is how we'll get there in this course, at least. Okay, so instead of seeing transcendence as a state of consciousness, I like to see it more as a path, a journey. To transcend means to go beyond, and one must ask, beyond what? To what goal, as in, what is beyond, and to what effect? I see transcendence as a constantly fleeting state of going beyond the belief of who you are as the sum of your thoughts and your separation to the rest of the world. I like this explanation of transcendence being a journey, being fleeting, impermanent, because it is the process that is more important than the destination. Through different techniques such as meditation, Tai Chi, Qigong, walking in nature, swimming, and more, we're able to go beyond the thought of who we are by the sum of past and yearning for the future in order for us to be totally present. Once we're totally present, beautiful things happen. We let go. We let go of the internal conflict of being in constant war against nature, against the world. Because we start to realize that there is more to us than what we think and explain within the limitation of our own languages. I try to avoid talking about such theories as unified field, cosmic consciousness, and so on. Although I did in the past, and I apologize. Not because I don't believe in the possibilities that they might be true, not that I don't believe that they are true, or because I don't think that they're beautiful, valid ideas, but precisely because they are just that, ideas. And the goal of transcending is something else, the opposite, going beyond these ideas. I've seen and I have lived it personally too, and these ideas and concepts transformed into certainty by wicked-minded people and groups can have really awful repercussions. And so when you practice the meditations, just do so as if nothing matters. It doesn't matter what you experience because that is just an opinion. Don't try to quote-unquote get there, because if you do, you won't. Don't reproduce a feeling of presence in the past, because this brings you back to the past. Don't expect an experience because this is a yearning for the future. You're not here, you're not there. You should be here. I'm not a Buddhist by any means. I don't follow any kind of dogma or religion apart from really as pragmatic as possible and in a search. But they have a word in Buddhism that I find is the best way possible to describe this path. And that is the word surrender. So you must surrender. That means that you will sit down and practice your meditation having let go of a goal, having let go of expectations, having let go of the past. You surrender who you are at that moment if you wish to go beyond that and experience something else, something new. You must accept, you observe, you accept, you surrender, and you go, you transcend. We must let go of this craving for higher states of consciousness, enlightenment, and so on. This is something I often hear. I want to have higher state of this wanting is never going to happen. Our goal in life is not to become a Buddha. And if it is, then it should not be. For if there was a Buddha, we don't have the means to imagine what it really is, just like we don't have the means to imagine the infinite of the universe or of the creation of God. We'll talk about enlightenment because it's an important subject that we must touch on, but not now. So let go. Let go of these cravings. Let go of these yearnings. We must let go in order to find ourselves, to transcend our egos, and to have a glimpse at the nature of ourselves. I love this quote that I've contemplated on a lot by Marcus Aurelius, Emperor of Rome, Stoic philosopher. It's always the same guys. It's always Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, people like this. I love to quote them. I feel they're my teachers. They're dead 2,000 years ago, but I feel they're my teachers. Anyway, he says, the human being is born with an inclination towards virtue. And so we can interpret this quote in many ways. I would like to share with you this the perspective of my own contemplation on this topic, and I highly suggest that you might do the same. Although we've been told for centuries to be weighed down by the notion of original sin, you know, Adam and Eve, our human species will not have survived any of its evolutionary steps had we not helped and been good to each other along the way. Rufus, another Stoic philosopher, says something along the lines of, all of us have been made by nature so that we can live free from error and nobly. Not that one can and another can't, but all. I like this because we were all made from nature. That's undeniable. We were born with an attraction to virtue and self-mastery. As Marcus says, born with an inclination towards virtue. All things in nature have, when we defy our preconceptions and look at the bigger picture. And so a child is not born corrupt. This is, again, one of my beliefs. But I don't believe that a child can be born evil. Even the most evil person that you can think of at the moment, I don't believe that as a child, as a baby, he was born that way. I have this picture of recently seeing my own baby boy opening his eyes for the first time when I was holding him skin to skin after his first few minutes on Earth. I could feel his consciousness being expressed and his love and purity. And I cannot fathom the thought that it is different with any other baby, with any other parent. Corruption and evil happens over time by nurturing the wrong things and the wrong ideas. Depending on his environment and education, a child will become good or evil. It is not born that way. Seneca says, philosophy is a tool to strip away these bad things and bad ideas so that we can return to our true nature. Philosophy can be also meditation. Philosophy is a vast term, right? And in my mind, philosophy and meditation are very similar. They're practically synonyms. To meditate on something means to think about something with an intense focus and by bypassing the automated thoughts and judgments that come in our mind during that process. This is not the idea that we have the practice of meditation because, of course, we're always told to eliminate thoughts, which, as we have probably all tried, it's impossible to do actively, especially in an intellectual level. To eliminate thoughts, we have to do it passively without the intent of doing so. Otherwise, again, infinite loops. So to come back to the Stoic philosophers, I do have a liking in the thought that our goal is not necessarily to improve or to get better or to reach higher states of consciousness, of awakening and enlightenment, but rather to go back to the source and to stay there as best we can. Because we were, as Marcus Aurelius and Seneca and all his friends say, we were all born good. We are not born evil. We are born by the miracles of nature. We don't come to the world, we come from the world, Alan Watts said. And all interpretations of all this are only that, interpretations. It's exactly what we said before. Transcendence means that a dog is no longer a dog. It's woof woof. And you're no longer a human being. You are a... This is what we try to find out. About transcendence, but I also really like the term self-transcendence because it is a bigger description, a better description of my interpretation of the states of consciousness. Because first and foremost, we transcend the self. We go beyond our ego and beyond the association of our thoughts, of the voice in our head talking with words in different languages, as opposed to talking in woof-woof languages, being symbiotic with true reality. Again, what reality cannot say, because reality cannot be described with words. To a certain extent, and with obvious limitations, I do believe that reality can be expressed in sound and vibration. Not any vibration. It must be a vibration to which we don't attach meaning, or at least too much meaning to it. A vibration that we listen with deep focus, with deep intensity, whilst remaining totally relaxed. It's a deep focused listening, yes, and it is intense, but it must also be somewhat effortless and gentle. Again, passive. I know that it's very controversial, and I just said exactly the opposite to what I just said a second earlier. Intense and effortless. But that's the best way I can describe the process. Don't try to understand what I'm saying, but do it, feel it, disengage your ego and follow your instinct. Focus on the vibration, you know, with intense focus on the foreground of your mind, but with absolute effortlessness. Remember our best friend. Remember our best friend. What's his name? Woof woof. And so by listening deeply and effortlessly to the vibration, keeping our minds active in our listening, this will bring our thoughts from the foreground in his everyday life to the background. The simple moving of the thoughts can sometimes be enough for some to realize that they are not identified by their own thoughts, but to much, much more than that. The shift of the thoughts from the foreground to the background allows us to dive deeper within. This allows us to experience glimpses of who we really are at our natural state. There's nothing magic about this, although it can feel quite magical. The deeper we go within ourselves, the deeper we are able to experience the very core of our being, the very core of our existence, the very core of our natural non-relative realities. We transcend the ego because we go within by going beyond the thoughts. And as we have talked about before, thoughts are our tools to examine and interpret reality. They are flawed by our own humanity, by our constant need of having an opinion or a point of view. There are no points of views when you go deep within, because there is the experience of one view being what it is supposed to be. This stream of thoughts that constitutes what we wrongly think of ourselves also includes the past and the future. The past, because our current thoughts originate from past thoughts, ideas, and symbols that we had in the past, our interpretation of our realities, and they also originate from the thoughts of others, that is to say, the opinions of others towards us and towards the meaning of life. The future here represents the same procedure of sub-realities that are created at the conditional tense, as in If I meditate well, then I will be enlightened. That is another flow of fleeting thoughts that are bypassed while we transcend ourselves. And so, what is left is the source of our nature as perfect beings. Perfect not in the idea of what we should be, but in the fact of what we are. This is why you might have seen in comments to my videos that some people lose track of time. 20 minutes seem to pass by very fast, even though we're just sitting there training to do nothing, which in other circumstances, and as you might have seen in our preliminary exercises, can seem like hours. We lose the track of time because we simply stop time. Yes, you heard that right. We stop time. Do we stop time for us only or for others too? Some like to ask. And my question is, well, what separates you from others? Your skin, your ideas, your mind, your thoughts? Is that really enough? I am asking you here, so please pause this if you can and take the time to answer. That's a very important question. Why and how does the time stop? Well, it's very simple. If we are in a state of consciousness that enables us to bypass concepts that are made by men, if we transcend the feeling of who we are, means that we are able to go beyond ourselves as fleeting ideas of existence. And so there is this realization, the awareness, the fact that time is an illusion, that it doesn't exist. When time doesn't exist, we have the feeling or the interpretation of the feeling that it stops. And therefore, 20, 30 minutes might feel to you as if it was really 3 or 5 minutes. Sometimes people ask me if they fell asleep. Well, that is completely possible. That is completely possible. This is also why we sit and we don't lie down. But that doesn't matter. I started saying in my head, the purpose of this meditation is to transcend and not to sleep. But I stopped myself right now, right here, because that is wrong. This meditation has no purpose, and if you need to sleep, then sleep. For the last few hundred years, we've been told that if we sleep too much, we're lazy. There's no reason that your body would oversleep. That's for sure. There's no reason that your body would oversleep. If it needs to sleep, it's because it is tired, and when we are tired, we need to sleep. There's no reason that your body at its natural state would overeat. Overeating, overdrinking, oversleeping, all of these things that we should do naturally but do too much or too little of is because we have lost touch with reality. We have lost touch with our senses, with our true perceptions via our natural systems. It has all been corrupted by the illusion of thoughts as being the only reality. So if you fall asleep, it simply means that your body or your mind or both as one is tired. We've talked about Zen before very, very briefly when we talked about being in symbiosis with our surrounding. I gave you a little example of a musician that plays her instrument as if it were a natural extension of her arm, or how good horse riders would be almost like a centaur because there's such a flow that we forget who is riding who. Another way to explain Zen is exactly what we're talking about here. When you're hungry, you eat. When you're thirsty, you drink. When you're tired, you sleep. Again, I have digressed, but this is very interesting because we've become slaves to our thoughts to the point of going against nature. Now, we're used to going against nature in this day of age, but if we sit down, close our eyes, and contemplate on that thought that we're against nature, that we act against our own nature, our physical nature, it's quite outstanding. So think about it. And even more than that, because we think we're such intelligent beings, we can debate and prove to our systems, our natural systems, that we know better, but we don't. This is what needs transcending. This is precisely what we need to get beyond of. Our thoughts as our bosses, our employers, our slave masters. You're hungry, but you'll tell yourself not to eat because the big arm of the clock doesn't show the number 12 yet. Or you don't go to bed even though you feel the tiredness pulling you down like gravity because you have an idea you want to exploit, or you want to catch up on that TV show, or you need to work, and sleep is regarded as highly unproductive. You're not hungry, but you have a craving and a yearning for that taste in your mouth. Not once, but many times in a row, we have lost our self-control. And this is what is tragic. And this is also why we need to practice these meditative processes of transcending the thoughts that have become slave masters to us and enabling us to act against our true nature. And so I think we need to finish on this lecture and move on to the next lecture because it's been long enough. But I think it is very important to keep that in mind, that transcending doesn't necessarily mean that we will go to a heightened state of consciousness, or that we will go higher, we'll be more awakened, we'll be more enlightened, we'll be better, growing all the time. Yes, it will happen. It's by definition, it will. But I think that it's also really good to contemplate on, instead of getting better, of getting back. Of getting back to who we are, to who we really are, when we listen to nature, when we listen to our instincts, as opposed to listening to our constant and relative arrays of thought.